for those enrolling, which of those do you prefer? I mean, I'm happy, of course, not to do any marketing. That makes my life easier. And I think that at this level of course, it's probably true that it's more of a formality, but it's also true that if you want to really learn the material, doing exercises is a useful way to do it. And it's often true that because you're busy, if there's not an incentive to do the exercises, then they tend to not get done. So the people that are enrolled in the course, do you have a preference? If I were to poll you now as to whether you'd prefer pass/fail or marking scheme, which would be a letter grade of some sort based on an assignment or two assignments probably, but lengthy assignments. Yeah, so some of these people have taken the standard model course. It's kind of probably not quite that lengthy, but just because I haven't had a chance to build up a roster of questions that's that long yet. But it would be because I'm not. I mean, the other way we could go is we could have shorter assignments and have an exam or something. But in courses like this, and it's harder to ask anything interesting in an exam. So the questions all tend to be either something that's very easy or impossible. And so, but given that, who would vote for pass/fail course, say? And who would vote for honest to God letter grade marking? All right, so most of you want to be, so you abstained. I think everyone else I think who's enrolled in it voted, but
there's a pass/fail.
I think you get credits. Yeah, I think the only difference from the point of view of the university is, I think the reason they have these pass/fail courses is that with these upper level courses, what often happens is everybody gets an A or something. And for some courses, when they're deciding fellowships, they want to, particularly master's level courses, they want to have some sort of a way of differentiating amongst the students. So the main thing would be whether they'd use this for that or not. But I think from the point of view of the credits, I think it's, at least in McMaster, it counts as part of your credit load. So I would think it's the same thing in Waterloo, but we have to check that. So you're wondering with the issue of whether or not it fulfills your course requirements, right? Yeah. Yeah, so the rest of you guys, when you voted for honest to God courses, was that the issue, whether or not it counts as a credit? Or is it because you really want to understand the material? Why don't I find out? I'll ask the question of the Waterloo end, of the McMaster end, what the credit rule would be in that choice. But the sense I'm getting is that unless the vote were to change, most people would prefer to have an honest to God assignment. One thing I don't know I could look into is whether or not you can mix and match. So it might be that we can offer this course and I could assign grades to a subset of the people in it and the rest could get a pass/fail mark. That's something which I don't mind doing either. So it's, for me, the trade-off is if there's only one person.
What if you put something in discuss it?
Yeah, talk it amongst yourselves. That makes sense. For me, the only constraint is that if I'm going to go through the effort of making these assignments and things, I wouldn't want to do it for one student or something. So that a significant number of you would have to take it as a mark thing for. And I can make up some assignments and not mark them if you want to kind of just do assignments, but not take it as that, but still take it as pass/fail. What I'll do is I'll find out whether there's a correlation between credit and pass/fail versus marks. And I don't think there is one, but I'll check that. And you guys can think about it because I don't think we have to decide, before next week. Okay. And I think I'm always supposed to. If in the event that we're doing this on marks, it's always good practice to say what the marks will be based on. So I've told you that it will be assignments. And then this year we're supposed to tell everybody that if everybody gets the flu, there may be some special arrangements we have to make at the last minute. So you've been warned. So if you all die or something, then.
Do you still get an A for death?
Yeah, that's right. You get an F1 H1 or H1 N1. All right. Did you guys have any procedural questions? So that was everything I was going to say. All right. And I hope you guys will stop me and ask questions. Because those of you who took the standard model course know that I just talk faster and faster and faster and faster. And then at some point, It just decouples. So what I want to do now is give you a pitch as to what the point of the course would be, just kind of in brief, you know, in summary, so you can kind of see where we're going to go. And then I'll give you the syllabus, and you'll see when we get to the syllabus that there's way more things that we can do here in the fall. And so when you see the syllabus, what you should be doing is it broadly breaks up into principles of effective field theories and then a lot of applications. And the applications are divided into relativistic and non-relativistic. And so what you should be thinking about is if there's any particular examples you want to have done, then let me know, because we can mix and match a little bit as to which ones we look at, because almost certainly we're going to run out of time before the term ends, and we won't get to all the applications. But part of what makes this subject cool is that the applications, because what it really drives home is that the principles, this is not a particle physics technique or a condensed matter physics technique or a gravity technique. This is a technique of theoretical physics, period. And it's got applications everywhere. And it's the more you look at different fields, the more it's easier to understand them using this as the organizing principle. That if you're, you know, I know for myself, learning condensed matter physics, you learn condensed matter physics as a particle physicist, as an undergraduate, when you're still wet behind the ears and you're not thinking for yourself yet. And so it's a story. But when you start thinking about it yourself again later on and you think, well, why do you believe anything? Then what's often true is that the issue is always, what's the theoretical error in your predictions? And so if your prediction is wrong, what did you learn? Did you just throw away a model and you get to replace it with another model? Or did you actually learn something which is really take to the bank, fatal to the principle? And it's often true that what organizes the theoretical error and the accuracy of the prediction are low energy approximations, which the effective field theory method makes explicit and organizes in an efficient way. And so it's a very useful way to approach another field, because it's a common language that you all have with every field. And so it's easier to understand what they're doing when you see it in a context which is similar to what you're used to doing in your own area. So that's part of the appeal of all these examples. Now let me give you the testimonial. So this is the motivation section. I guess at some point I should tell you what the course is about. The course is about effective field theories. And so I've got a kind of a list of about five things that I hope to get across, or six things I want to get across. These various examples are supposed to be driving home a larger lesson, and these are the larger lessons. So the first thing is that it's just a fact of nature that, as you know, having been physicists for as long as you have, physical systems often come with a variety of mass scales. And so there's lots of examples of that. There's the standard ones from particle physics would be that most of the fermions, like the electrons and the quark, or the proton, are much lighter than the W boson and the Z boson. But there's lots of examples from undergraduate physics that, you know, the energy levels in an atom are of the order of, you know, 1/2 alpha squared times electron mass, and that's much less than the electron mass itself, which is saying that the physics in the atom is non-relativistic. And so I'm comparing apples and oranges here. I'm always using units where h bar and c is 1, and that's alpha, and Boltzmann constant is 1. And so that means all units are energy units, so I'll use GeV for everything, or inverse dV for the length and times. And I'm sure you're happy with those units. But if you haven't been looking at the PSI lectures on PIRSA, Nima Markani-Hamad's first lecture is about dimensional analysis. And so he makes a pitch as to why these are God's units, and that or why these are the more efficient units than the units that you normally would use, and that there's more information in them. So GEV will be our unit of choice. And what makes it useful is basically that that's roughly a proton mass. So it's a physical scale it comes up off. So now, because they're so different, that this is two of them, but you know, there's I want to make the point that there's lots of other examples. There's if you're in condensed matter physics, a superconducting scale would be something like Kelvin, which is like 10 to the minus 4 electron volts. Whereas the energies of conduction electrons, say, might be 10 to 100, or more like 100, say, Kelvin, which would be like 10 to the minus 2 electron volts. So that's a hierarchy of scale. There's in electromagnetism, you're often doing an expansion in something like a dipole moment or some size characteristic of the source divided by distance from the source. So the multipole expansion. Again, that's hierarchies of length scale, which you can think of as hierarchies of energy scale. Coming here, another one hit me and I've forgotten it already. Oh yeah, things like equilibrium and the fluid approximations. So if you're looking at, there's a time scale associated with coming to equilibrium, or there's a time scale to do with molecular interactions. And if you're looking at long time scales compared to that, then you can usually think in terms of equilibrium or thermodynamics or fluid dynamics. So it's times much longer than an equilibrium time or a molecular time. So again, that's a hierarchy of scales. And the last one was, forgot the last one. So the main thing is that it just drives home that it's something which is not unique to particle physics or gravity physics. Oh, the Planck scale was the obvious one. Yeah. Everything we know, small compared to Planck scale. And so on. So what? So the point number one is that it, just at the very pragmatic level of calculating things, it's useful to expand in the small ratio. That could be powers of alpha if it's this ratio, or it could be powers of mass ratios. And and that simplifies your answer, of course. One way to approach everything would be to calculate everything exactly and then tailor expand all the answers at the end of the day in these small ratios. That's the hard way to do things. The easier way to do things is to use the ease of calculation that comes with that expansion as early as possible in your calculation, because you'll be able to calculate more, because it's just easier to do. But it brings things within the domain of the possible. So it's point number one is that it pays to simplify using an expansion in powers of small mass ratios, so m small, or small scale ratios, m large, as early as possible. And effective field theories are the earliest as possible way to do this. So in particular, if you're interested in atomic physics and you're trying to neglect the nucleus, so this, what counts here is the energies of atoms versus the nuclear scales. A hard way to do that would be to calculate everything involving, take every observable and then take the observables and separately tailor expand them all in this ratio. A more efficient way to approach it is to take your Hamiltonian that you're calculating things with and do the expansion already in the Hamiltonian and then calculate any observable you want with that Hamiltonian. So in particular, the idea is to take the influence of M large and replace it by local effective interactions. And then use those to calculate your favorite observable. And the key thing is that they're local, and that's the uncertainty principle is telling you that given that you're discriminating you're trying to ignore states that are very energetic or very short range or very fast compared to the physics that you're trying to follow. The uncertainty principle says that its influence is going to be restricted to be over a small range of times if it's high energy, or a small range of distances if it's high momentum in its influence. And so then you can, so any matrix element you would calculate in quantum mechanics in the full theory can be approximated by some local thing, precisely because the thing that you're trying to describe is taking place at very, very quickly or at very high energies compared to what you're trying to follow. And so the uncertainty principle is what's underlying this locality. Otherwise, you would have thought that you're going to get some arbitrary mess which you can never unravel. This is what's making this thing. Because we're ignoring high energy or mass or whatever. So one of the last topics is going to be cases where the things you're ignoring are not necessarily high mass. So examples where you're not ignoring high energies, it would be if you're looking at one of those last examples, the fluid mechanics example, if you've got a particle moving through a medium, say, where it's a thermal medium, so that there's lots of energy, lots of states in the medium that you can access with the energies available to you with this particle moving through it. And you'll see that the description of that kind of a process will be different qualitatively than the description of what you're normally doing in these effective Lagrangian kind of calculations, where you're imagining that the sector that you're ignoring is very, very heavy and there's not enough energy to excite it. And one of the things that'll be a worry will be locality because of this uncertainty principle argument. So for most of the examples I'm going to look at, it's just a single, we're going to use energy as the defining criterion that tells us what's the sector we're going to ignore and what's the sector we're going to keep. We're going to be following low energies compared to high energy things. And we're asking what's the influence of the high energy physics in low energy physics processes. And we're going to find local things because the basic thing we started with was this differentiation based on energy. And it's because energy is conserved that if you start off with no states at high energies, you will never get them from processes involving the lower energy things. And so what's important is that we're discriminating states based on conserved quantities in what we're going to do. I'm imagining that we do for this first to start off with. I'm imagining that we're God, we know what all the energies are, but we know that there's two of them that are very different, and we're going to focus on the low energy process, and we're trying to see how the high energy process affects the low energy process because we're interested in taking our observables and expanding in this ratio of the energies of the processes, and to the extent it depends on the high energy one, we're asking what does the high energy physics do to the low energy physics. Well, so the basic assumption of effective field theories is that anything that the high energy physics did could be parameterized by some local interaction in the Hamiltonian. And the reason that works, the key word is local there. And so the reason that's working is the uncertainty principle. That if you start off at low energies, you don't have the energy conservation would have forbidden you from producing a high energy state, but you can do it fast enough if you because of the uncertainty principle. But you can only do it over very short times because of the uncertainty principle. If you wait long enough, then you'll never be able to affect, your ability to introduce a high energy state into a low energy process will be most efficient at small times because of the uncertainty principle. So if you're looking for what the effective interaction will be that captures the physics of the high energies at low energies, it will tend to be a local thing in time. It won't involve operators that are separated in time by long distances because of the uncertainty principle. And there's a similar space momentum story there too. So what you're going to find is that the kinds of interactions that will capture high energy physics you'll see in low energy situations will tend to be some arbitrary thing consistent with your symmetries that's local, and that tends to be what you're using to specify what your theory is anyway. Some arbitrary thing which was local, satisfying some symmetries, and so that's why it's. The high energies are appearing in a controllable way. Right, so the message here was the technique itself is a way of capturing high energy physics for the purposes that think, say, nuclear physics. If you're trying to describe low energy physics like atomic physics and you're asking how can the nucleus appear, there's not a lot of ways it does appear. And an effective field theory will be an efficient way of organizing how it appears, how the nuclear scale appears in the answer. But what the spin-offs of that are, there's many spin-offs of that. One is that it's a fact of nature that experimental fact. Most properties, most of the details of the high energy part of the problem are relevant to the low energy part. And that fact of nature is normally called decoupling. That's why science progresses, right? You didn't have to understand nuclear physics to understand the atom. That was a good thing, it turned out. And if you asked what features of nuclear physics were important for understanding the atom, some things were important. You need to know the mass of the nucleus, the charge of the nucleus, things like that. But you didn't need to know more than that. You didn't need to know that the nucleus was made out of protons and neutrons and they were made of quark. A lot of that was irrelevant. And so the good news is that the mathematics we're describing nature with, quantum field theory, has the same property. The quantum field theory shares this property. So if you calculate the high energy implications, the implications of high energy degrees of freedom on low energy observables, most things don't show up. And that's why this is a technique that's going to be useful, that is in practice useful. And so when you organize the ways in which high energy physics can appear in low energy physics, there's not a lot of ways it can do that. And that's the mathematics expressing this fact of nature, which is a good thing. But in particular, what you're generally interested in physics is how to test what you know. So the two things you want to know are, what are the high energy features are important? So you want to know, in particular, which energy features are important or not important at low energy. So that's the question of what things do I need to know about? So how much ignorance can I afford to have? And the second thing is you want to know which low energy processes are most sensitive and least sensitive to high energies. And the reason you want to know these things, this one particularly, the second one is, if you don't understand the high energy physics, like you don't understand nuclear physics or you don't understand quantum gravity or something else, and you want to know, but I've made a prediction at low energies that I like the value of fine structure constant is 1/137 point blah, 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 then that's not really not a prediction. So if you predict Josephson effect, so you make a prediction that's very accurate, you want to know part of the process of comparing the experiment is that the theoretical error has to be as accurate as the experimental error. And you want to be sure that the things you don't understand at high energies, and eventually there are energies we don't understand, don't pollute what you're calculating. So the things that are least sensitive will be the ones that you're going to, will be conversely the most robust to the details of high energy physics. And so you're going to want, those will be the things for which you can expect to have the most accurate comparisons and the most reliable comparisons. The second thing, though, is that if you can identify, there are typically, although most things don't depend on nuclear physics and atomic physics, some things do. And so, for example, hyperfine splitting depends on nuclear physics because there's a symmetry being broken by the nuclear physics that was not being broken without the nuclear physics. And so you wouldn't see anything there at all unless you had the nuclear physics. And so it's useful to identify those specific, most observables won't care much about high energy physics, but some will. If you can identify what those are, then you'll learn the most about the higher energy physics that you don't know about yet. And that will be one of the ways to learn about it. And so since this is a place where quantum gravity is a big deal, one of the topics will be gravity, because these questions, of course, come up in spades in that case, and that there's really ignorance as to what's going on at high energies. And so you want to know what's robust against that. Why does our basic picture work at low energies, given that we don't understand much there? And then the second thing you want to know is, what can you look at which is sensitive to the details up there? There's not a lot of things, but the ones that are that you want to identify, so you can, as efficiently as possible, test what you're doing. That's kind of contained in the statement, but this is more the statement. Those are like the marginal things. This is the statement that most perturbations are irrelevant. And so at low energies, most things you're not sensitive. They're dying like powers of the energy scale. And then the marginal interactions that are not suppressed by powers of this ratios of energies might logarithmically depend on the energies. And those will be the things that you're talking about where you're looking at how they flow. But they're kind of a subset of this general statement that most of the things you do are suppressed by powers of energy. Point three is actually part of this one already, so I won't say it again. It's the issue of how. Well, I'll just skip that one. Now, related to this is that it can happen that some predictions. Depend only on symmetries and the low energy expansion we're talking about. Even if this is not how they're first derived. Obvious. In the full theory. And when this happens, it's great because it means you've got very, very robust predictions, which would be very puzzling to understand without an effective field theory treatment of it. So the classic examples of this are things like the things that are very accurate, so that like the Josephson effect or the quantum Hall effect or the BCS theory, superconductors and quantum in condensed matter physics in particular, where the systems are so dirty and there's lots of things going on and it's hard to really pick out the details. You have to make lots of approximations in your theory to make the predictions. You typically expect that the errors in your predictions should be quite big because you're making lots of really dramatic approximations. And so one of the big puzzles for an outsider in condensed matter physics was that these two things, the quantum Hall effect and the Josephson effect, are the things that you use to measure the fine structure constant. So that's fine structure constant alpha is known, to a part per billion or better. And so the way that the value is known is you compare the frequency, the Josephson effect frequency, or you compare the quantized level in the quantum Hall effect to the prediction, and it just depends on, the electric charge divided by H bar, and that's what's giving you the fine structure constant. But to really learn the fine structure constant from that, you would have had to believe the prediction of the Josephson effect and the quantum Hall effect to an accuracy of better than a part per billion because you're comparing it at that level. And if you think of how those things are predicted, the Josephson effect is something which happens in a superconductor. So it was predicted, it was first predicted in the context of the BCS theory. And in the BCS theory, what do? You throw away all the Coulomb interactions amongst the electrons, and you focus on this very weak phonon interaction where an electron moves, it polarizes, it attracts all the surrounding nuclei towards itself. If there's a little enhanced, if you have a little overabundance of electrons in some region that attracts the nuclei very weakly towards it, and then that little charge cloud can act to attract another electron towards the first one because there's the effect of positive charge that the first one polarized is now attracting the second one, and that pairing is what's driving the superconductor. But you threw away a lot of things that were much bigger than that in the Coulomb interaction in particular. And you would have thought that, so if you make a successful prediction there, if you get a factor of two, you're happy because you're throwing away really dramatic things. But BCS predictions in a superconductor typically work to a few percent, or they can work to a few percent. So that in itself is already amazing. And the Josephson effect, you would have thought if it relies on the BCS theory, you'd be nuts to believe that to 10 decimal places. And the reason you can is that once you understand the Josephson effect of what's going on, it really only relies on the BCS theory to predict that there was a superconductor in the sense that there's a symmetry breaking pattern that's happening in the system. But once you grant that the symmetry broke, so the thing became a superconductor, then at low energies, the Josephson effect, the quantization involved in the Josephson effect or the quantum Hall effect, those things are robust consequences of the existence of the symmetry breaking and the low energy limit compared to the scale of the symmetry breaking. And so the reason, and then gauge invariance, basically, and that which is an exact property. So the things that you're comparing to experiment there are extremely reliable because the errors in them are being controlled by this low energy approximation and not by the things that you thought were controlling the theory that gave the approximation in the theory that you first derived them in. So it's very useful to know when this is true because it means that it's a special case of this of the low energy processes that are very insensitive to the details of the high energy physics. And the power of symmetry arguments at low energy can often be very constraining in identifying in what it allows the degrees of freedom to do. That was three. So then four. So part of this process you're going to see is effective field theories. They explain the physics. Behind the renormalization program. So when you take, you know, for instance, in QED, you know, what you do is you calculate, if you're calculating, say, the d minus 2 of the electron, you're calculating processes like electron comes through, emits a photon, then you calculate processes where photons are connecting, and you look at power. You calculate everything in powers of alpha. So you get p is equal to 2, 1 plus alpha over pi, plus da 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 da. And this is, again, something you compare to 10 decimal places to experiment. It's something statistically accurately. But you know that if you do complicated, this particular graph I think is already finite, but if you do more complicated graphs, the problem is that in general, these graphs diverge from virtual momenta that are very large. So that's the UV divergence. And then what's happening is that divergence is being canceled by a dependence of the cutoff. So you regulate those divergences, and then the cutoff in that regularization can be absorbed in a cutoff dependence in the various parameters in the theory, like the value of alpha, say, and depend on that cutoff. And the miracle is that you cancel. So you know what the mathematicians always bar for this. Basically, you have two infinite things that you subtract with an enormous ambiguity as to what the finite parts were in them, and then you compare the answer to the experiment to 10 decimal places, and it works. And so it seems like it seemed for a long time in particle physics like that's a really bizarre thing to do. And if it didn't work so well, people would have probably not done it. But the effective field theory techniques explain what's going on and why it's not a miracle. In particular, the things that are problems here are the very high frequency things. So it's a special case of this general, you've got scales that you're trying to separate. And the fact that you can absorb the effects of this very high frequency stuff into various effective couplings in your theory is not a miracle. It's something which had to happen on general grounds. And so this crisis that renormalization seems so bizarre that people had in the 60s, and it was not stupid people. People like Feynman and Dirac really thought that there was a physical problem there. We now understand to be it's just a way in which the calculation is efficiently organized. So the renormalization program has a very nice physical picture behind it. But the bonus from that is that it tells you what to do with a non-renormalized, that all worked in renormalizable theories. But it, so the effective field theories tell us how to calculate. And some make predictive. Non-renormalizable theories. Non-renormalizable. And there's many theories in nature that are not renormalizable. The Fermi theory, the weak interactions, you know, general relativity and other ones. And effective field theories, as part of this story, tell you what's special about, or tell you how to think about the people have for a long time thought that non-renormalizable theories were like renormalizable theories, but the problem was that you needed an infinite number of these renormalizations, these couplings to absorb the divergences in. And so then, since you had an infinite number of things to renormalize, you didn't predict anything because you had more parameters than you had things to calculate. And that turns out to have been a fallacy that came from the fact that the physics behind the program was not clear. And so once you understand what you're doing, then it's possible to be predictive with non-renormalizable theories at the quantum level, just like you can with renormalizable theories. And in particular, you can calculate the quantum corrections to the classical predictions for gravity in the solar system, and they're, you know, 1 part in 10 to the 80th. And that's something which is an important conceptual point when you're comparing non-renormalizable theories like gravity to experiment, because part of the theoretical error was the size of the quantum effect. And if you said that those things were, you couldn't estimate them, then it was meaningless to compare the classical prediction to experiment because you didn't know what the full prediction was, since we know that quantum mechanics exists. So what that would have said, if you couldn't quantify the quantum error in the places you're testing general relativity experimentally, what you're essentially saying, if you don't understand how to calculate the quantum size of quantum effects, is that there's an uncontrolled theoretical error, so you don't have a theoretical prediction to compare to. So the huge success, the quantitative success in testing general relativity, or the Fermi theory, the weak interactions, or other theories that are not renormalizable, the ability to test those things, even if you're using them classically, implicitly assumes that the things that you did not calculate, the quantum corrections for them, were small, and effective field theories tell you how to quantify how big they are and to show that they really are small, and so and when they can be important. So, and to, in particular, quantify when quantum effects are and are not important. And if you're a cosmologist, where all the calculations are essentially done in the classical approximation, one of the first things that should always be done, but is often not done, is to ask, what's the validity of the classical approximation? And am I inside that validity domain when I'm doing my calculation? And that's not always true that people are. And so that's an important in practice issue for gravity and cosmology. And the last part of this is that because it tells us how renormalizable theories and non-renormalizable theories are related to one another, effective theories explain why renormalizable theories play such a role in nature. So, why we find renormalizable theories so useful in explaining nature. In the old days, people thought that although renormalization was ugly, renormalizability was an ugly criterion, it at least had the virtue of being predictive, that you could say that if I was trying to decide what the theory of particle physics was, renormalizability gives me a strong constraint and can make the standard model the unique thing I look at if I choose my particles appropriately. And then once I've got it, I can test it. And in the past, those renormalizable choices have worked extremely well, and that was part of the reason for taking renormalizability seriously, was the observational evidence that it worked so often in nature. But now that we understand how to understand predictive, how to make predictions in non-renormalizable theories, we understand when the renormalizable theories are better. And the short version of the story is that in this, you're always doing implicitly an expansion in powers of some low energy divided by some high energy, some power. And you're imagining that some observable is a series. It's something which is some zeroth order thing, you know, 1 plus, you know, A e over m to some power plus higher powers. And in particular, these coefficients could also involve logarithms of e over m. And the statement is that if the physics that you're at high energies that you're trying to describe by your low energy theory is sufficiently high, that to within the accuracy you're working, these powers are all too small to see, then the answer, the theory that you're going to be led to will always be renormalizable, because the renormalizable theory is the part of the theory which involves only logarithms of larger mass ratios, but it involves, does not capture any of the powers of E over M. So it would apply if M was arbitrarily large. Come up. And so you should expect that that when you get clean separations of scale that are very large, the theory describing the low energy limit should always be renormalizable, because that's the statement that what you're describing is the stuff that's zeroth order in this low energy expansion. And so the renormalizability versus non-renormalizability is just the issue as to how far along the series you're walking when you make your prediction and how accurate you can do it. And so that, for any fixed experimental accuracy, that will depend on what this ratio is, scale you're looking at compared to the scale you're not looking at. And you should just be always expecting to find that the renormalizable part is the leading piece, and then there's corrections. And so that's a useful thing to know. So welcome. We see you over on the screen. I guess I'm looking over there. Can you hear us all right? This is you on the screen? Okay, we can hear you. Okay. Sorry about that. That was my fault. So let me repeat just the very quick procedural things. You haven't missed anything, really. Procedural things were that the main thing is this board here. So there's no class this afternoon because of the concert that everybody's going to hear. And then 2 weeks from now, there's no class because I'm away. And then in these 2 weeks, we're going to change the room, but that won't affect you. So it's we won't have an afternoon class these 2 weeks because there's no room available. But we're going to find a time slot between 9 and 2, and it'll probably just be the 10 to 12 time slot, which we're always going to use from now on. The idea is to have 2 hours in the morning, 1 hour in the afternoon, and the afternoon we're probably going to lose these 2 weeks. Well, that's the only procedural issue. The other question was, if you're thinking of enrolling in the course, this is now everybody, if you weren't here before, there's an option of having it be a pass-fail course or to be a course based on letter grades, on which the grades would be based on several lengthy assignments, probably. And I'm asking you guys to think about what you should, what you would rather do. And I'm going to look into, I don't think it makes a difference from the point of view of the credit you get for the course, but I'm going to check that. And I'm going to also check whether or not I can make it pass-fail for some students and not pass-fail for other students. But the way you actually enroll in this course will depend on which it is, because in particular, Waterloo has a different way of they're set up for a course with marks, but the pass-fail course that this one would fit into doesn't exist yet, and so they would have you do as a visiting class. So. And you should jump in. We can hear you, but you're not very loud, so just if I don't hear a question, yell. Probably I should be pointing at something else. Oh, that's helping. Okay. Yeah, that's better, I think. Okay. So. Having given you the rah-rah pitch, let me describe the curriculum. And here, again, I'm hoping for some feedback as to which examples people would like me to do, because there's a broad class of examples as well as after the theoretical framework. So topics for the syllabus. So there's topic one is theoretical framework. So the way I'd like to do that is to break that into three subsections. So one is just in general how hierarchies of scale arise. And for that, I'm going to use a toy model where you can just explicitly see what's going on. We can calculate everything in the full theory. We can calculate it in the effective theory, and you'll see how that works. Then I want to define what these effective interactions, what the effective actions are. There's more than one thing you can define. So there's the one particle irreducible effective action, and there's the Wilson effective action, and so on. There's also the one light particle irreducible effective interaction. And then I'm going to talk about power counting and matching. And so this is the issue as to, if you have the full theory, how do you calculate what the effective theory is? Once you have the effective theory, how do you know how big the quantum corrections are? Or if you want to work to some order in the energy expansion, how many interactions you need to keep? And buried in this will be the story of renormalizability versus not renormalizability, and in particular, dimensional regularization. If you're doing any calculations at all, once you do quantum calculations, you know that that dimensional regularization is almost always easier than a cutoff regularization. And you might think that that's a fundamental problem in practice for effective field theories, because the way I'm describing them, they're going to naturally seem like they come with a cutoff associated as an important part of the story, in the sense that we're going to have high energy degrees of freedom. There'll be some states that are heavy, there'll be some states that are light, and we're going to take some intermediate scale lambda and say that we don't know anything about what's going on above here. How can we integrate out this physics above the scale lambda to describe the physics at low energies and how this high energy physics appears in that low energy physics? And so phrasing it that way makes it sound like this cutoff lambda is an important thing. And this is the lambda that you would be running into if you're doing the renormalization program for quantum electrodynamics with a cutoff, in the sense that in your low energy theory, you're integrating up to this highest scale lambda. That's your regulator at some level. And the fact that things depend strongly on lambda is what you don't like about the divergences that you get in your low energy theory, if your low energy theory had been quantum electrodynamics, say. But the story will be that lambda is just a bookmark. Really, the full theory had more stuff in it. And that when you integrate out the physics above lambda, you get effective interactions in your low energy Hamiltonian whose values, the couplings for which, depend on lambda, because that was part of their definition. And so the cancellation that seemed like a miracle in the 60s, that the lambdas in the coupling constants are canceling the lambdas in the explicit loop integrals at low energies compared to lambda, becomes an obvious statement that lambda is not really in the physical problem. Lambda is a bookmark where we're dividing high from low, but we could put lambda anywhere in here and it doesn't make any difference. The physics only depends on scale m and the little scale little m and whatever things came from still higher energies. So this cancellation of lambda that was a miracle in the renormalization program is really mundane in this effective field theory picture. But that makes it sound like lambda is important somehow, because it's what distinguishes high from low. And in practice, what you really want to do when you're calculating loops or anything is to work in dimensional regularization, for which you would keep all possible momenta up to infinity, but do it in not four dimensions, and then use the approach to four dimensions to regularize the ultraviolet divergences. And so part of this story will be that you can have it all. You can do effective field theories in dimensional regularization. And the short version of the logic is that the difference between keeping the frequencies in dimensional regularization up to infinity and not is a high energy thing. And that can always be captured by some local effective operator. So why not do it? And so the bottom line will be that the details of how you infer what the low energy theory is from the high energy theory won't be done by integrating only over some range of momenta, It'll be done by keeping or not keeping a particle. As if you're interested in energies below the mass of a particle or above the mass of a particle, you'll either keep it or not keep it in your theory. So you'll have an additional field in the high energy theory, but both of them will be dimensionally regularized. And there's nothing then that stops you from defining the low energy theory. But what you do is you typically call that more precisely a matching calculation rather than an integrating out calculation. Because what you do is you just define this low energy theory to be whatever it had to be to capture what was going on at high energies. So there's a conceptual issue which is important in practice, that professionals really use dimensional regularization when they do this. It's like you don't have to use dimensional regularization, but if you don't use dimensional regularization, then you lose the power of dimensional analysis, which is a very useful tool in this whole business. Because you have a scale in your problem which is large, lambda, but which is not in your answer, and it's hard on dimensional grounds to know when to keep it or not. That's a special case of one of Weinberg's three laws of theoretical physics. And one of the laws was you can use any variables you like to solve a problem, but if you use the wrong ones, you'll be sorry. And this is an example of that. The topic two is relativistic applications. I start with those because those will be the most familiar and they're the easiest to do. So I had a subset here which was in the standard model. So this is where the two scales involved we understand. So we can do the whole process of, we know the whole theory, we know the low energy theory, we can compare. So some of the examples would be photons and neutrinos, who have very low energies. Many of the properties of, the fact that they don't interact is the special case of the many things you can predict. QED in general, and in particular, the minimal subtraction versus decoupling subtraction and the running of couplings. The Fermi theory, which is one of the first ones that came up with it. And then the Goldstone bosons. Goldstone and chiral perturbation theory in QCD. So those are the topics I was thinking of doing there. And then I want to do non-relativistic applications. Some of which I've already alluded to. So there's a little bit of a theoretical background again. And that's to do with in relativistic problems, how time and space scale is the same. But in non-relativistic problems, it can be that you could be at very low energies, but not at low momenta. So if you're in a solid and you're near the Fermi surface, the energies available are very small. But you might have momenta which are some place in the Brillouin zone, which is appreciable, comparable to the wavelength, comparable to the the lattice spacing. So what would have been a very small wavelength mode is a very low energy mode. And so you have to separate momentum scaling from energy scaling. But once you've done that, then you're off to the races. Oh, did I miss one? Yes, I did. Thank you. Yeah, that was an important one, actually. What I'll do is I'll do it in this book. Yeah, that was the continuation of the standard models, and then this is when the high energy physics is not known. So there the oh, there's another example I forgot to say here. This is a center of mass motion. So you don't often we describe classical point particles as if they don't live with the rest of physics. And there's a, you can think of the center of mass motion of an object as being the low energy approximation, you know, the effective field theory of the Earth typically starts with where it is. And so when you think of the Earth as a point particle, Newton was doing effective field theory at some level when he was describing the orbit of the Earth. And so you can fit it in that context there. The higher physics not known had as subsets the standard model itself as an effective field theory. So what do we know about what's replacing the standard model? And the interesting thing about the last 10 years is that if you organize the standard model, if you thought of the standard model as being, because it's renormalizable, a leading term in a low energy expansion, and then you said, well, what possible things could I get in the low energy expansion, even though I don't know where they came from, just get governed by the symmetries and the particles we know at low energies. It turns out there's a unique thing which appears to first order in 1 over the heavy mass. And that unique thing, if it was there, the only way you would know it was there is that it would give you neutrino masses. So the tantalizing thing is that the one piece of experimental evidence the standard model does not describe by itself when it's renormalizable is neutrino masses. And so the one thing you would expect to see first is the one thing that has been seen. That's kind of an interesting observation. And then you can now ask what are the next things you should see and what does that tell you? And the other one was general relativity. As an effective field theory. So the story of quantifying the errors in the solar system for classical tests of general relativity. And there's a sub piece of this that I'd like to add, which I hadn't done, which kind of actually leads into the next section, which is this is actually fairly simple when you're not when you don't include the non-relativistic sources. But if you include non-relativistic sources, relativistic sources. So things like this, the center of mass motion and the corrections to it, the multiple moments of objects that are sourcing gravity, you can organize that too, but there's another scale in the problem, and that's also very, that's an active area of research now. All right, so then the applications part of this was going to be non-relativistic systems. So these are systems that are non-relativistic, but not, you know, degenerate or bizarre in other ways. So this includes NRQED, the way of describing the theory that describes the relativistic corrections in an atom, and how to systematically keep track of the hierarchy of scales. There is the ratio between the energy of the atom, say, and the momentum in an atom, which are controlled by powers of alpha. So many of the things that you thought were coming to you as a coupling constant in QED really come to you as a ratio of scales. And in particular, you get logarithms of it sometimes. There's a famous log alpha in the Lamb shift. And that's something which is easy to see in this context. There's a positronium and unstable particles. In chiral perturbation theory, there's two issues there. One of them is if you have states, the assumption in effective field theory is usually that you start off with light states. You've included all the light states in your problem, subject to conservation laws. And so all the things you did not include to start off with, you never get, because the conservation laws or energy conservation forbid you from getting them if you didn't start with them. But if you start off with something like, if you look at things like positronium, then we're going to be, if we're in the low energy approximation, we're looking at bound states, so we're neglecting energies below the electron mass. The way you get the non-relativistic theory is you integrate out the antiparticle, which is irrelevant at energy is low compared to the mass. But you can have situations where the low energy theory you have can decay into the particles that you were not keeping. So the low energies here were low energies compared to the electron mass, but if you can have them, if you have a positron and electron that can annihilate into and dump energy which is large compared to electron mass, that sounds like it's contradictory. But there's a story you can tell there. As long as it's rare, you can describe it. And what it means is that the effective theory you get is not unitary, because you're not keeping all the degrees of freedom, low energies. There's light scattering from molecules. So this is the story of why the sky is blue. So the electromagnetic properties of matter are very typically controlled by the low energy approximation. And then there's ferromagnets and antiferromagnets. So this is a continuation of the Goldstone boson section, the non-relativistic Goldstone bosons. And people often talk about ferromagnets as being the classic ordered system, and Goldstone bosons that you run into relativistically are just like magnons for ferromagnets, and that's actually false. It turns out that the things that we get in high energy physics are more like the Goldstone bosons you get for antiferromagnets, because ferromagnets break time reversal invariance, and there's interactions there that you wouldn't normally have. And so the dispersion relation for these Goldstone bosons is not the one that you would have expected from, instead of the frequency going like momentum, like you get in particle physics or for antiferromagnets, the frequency goes like the momentum squared for these Goldstone bosons, and there's a reason for that, and it's not a, it's a very pretty story, but it's not the same story that you normally tell. So that's the new thought there. Then the next category was the degenerate physics. So far that was all stuff which was, you could think of it as being effectively at zero density. But there's also a story about, so what number are we at now? Degenerate systems. And mostly what I want to do here is the effective field theory of the Fermi surface, which is the thing that describes, first of all, it tells you why the free electron model works for most metals. Why? And also it tells you why, when the BCS theory should work. So this process of neglecting all the Coulomb interactions and keeping only this one Fiebel interaction, there's a justification for it at low energies to do with the existence of the Fermi surface, which is was known in condensed matter physics, but it's it was you can particularly cleanly pull it out in this general framework I'm talking about here now. You can also do antiferromagnetic instability. So things like that would be the story of the Goldstone bosons in an antiferromagnet. This would be the story of why you get an antiferromagnet, or why you could get a spin. The same argument that says that you sometimes get an instability towards superconducting can also say that you might get an instability towards a charge density wave or a spin density wave, where you've got a position dependent condensate which is breaking another symmetry. So when what to choose is which is going on. And there's more general environments. So one is boundaries. So how does the high energy physics and the Casimir effect, so how do boundaries interplay with high energy physics? There's a nice story there. And then there's things like thermal environments. And then mean field theory. And the idea here is this is the story I was alluding to at the very beginning, that previously we're talking about the states we're ignoring are states that are in their ground state, essentially. And as long as you do things at low energies adiabatically, you never excite them from their ground state. But there can be situations like particles moving through a thermal environment or decoherence, where the thing you're trying to ignore is this huge environment. And it's not that you have enough energy to excite states there, but they're not perturbing it much. And so there's the way you organize that calculation most efficiently is to take advantage of hierarchies of scale. In general, it's a hard problem to know how a particle moves through an environment, but if it happens that the correlation time of the environment is short compared to the times you're interested in, then what happens is that as a particle moves through, in general, what would happen if a particle moves through an environment, what happens is it depends on the whole history of its interaction with the environment, and you have what's happening now will depend on exactly the details of what it did when it came through the environment. But if the correlation time of the environment, so the fluctuations in the environment, are very short timescales compared to what you're interested in, then effectively the particle forgets what happened to it in the past because it's being perturbed many times in a way which is not correlated for long times in the future. And so that makes it into a Markov process, that you can say things about what happens to it statistically without knowing in detail, just knowing its initial conditions. And so there's an effective evolution of the state that you can describe, which is controlled by this ratio of the small correlation time divided by the long time you're trying to follow. And that has applications in condensed matter physics and particle physics as well. The justification for the MSW resonant neutrino oscillations in the sun is controlled by that. People almost always say that neutrinos interacting in matter are very much like light moving through a glass, that you can think of the matter as being like an index of refraction, and that's actually deceptive. It's kind of true, but it's not really, it's really not a good, the analogy is a bad analogy, because if you think about why the issue for is always in these problems, why is the material not opaque? If you're getting something interesting like refraction or something, that means that you had to be scattering, and it's almost 100% scattering if you get a light beam to bend in some direction. But if you're getting scattering, why did it all go the same direction? Why didn't you get diffuse scattering as well that would make it opaque? And so why is it true that the distance through which you can see through an object is longer than the typical scattering length? So if you look at the photons in glass, you know, every 100 atoms or so, they're scattering from an atom because alpha is a 1 over 100. And but what's happening is that there's constructive interference happening in specific directions and canceling in other directions, which is making the channeling all the motion in one particular direction. And that coherence of that direction compared to the scattering that's diffuse is controlled by the number of things that are interfering with each other, so the number of scattering sites. And for light in glass, that's controlled by the number of, say, atoms in a wavelength, which can be many, many thousands, because wavelengths are many, many, much longer than the interatomic spacings. But for neutrinos in the sun, they're being produced by nuclear physics, so their wavelengths are nuclear size, and they're scattering. The density of the sun at the center of the sun is something like an Avogadro's number per cubic centimeter, so it's not so different from things on Earth. It's hydrogen, though, so that's really dense for hydrogen, but it's not so dense. So it's not true that there's many scattering sites in a particular in a given wavelength. And so the reason that the index of refraction story for neutrinos works in a solar environment, say, is an astrophysical environment, is very different from light, but it's controlled by this mean field long time compared to short correlation time approximation is what really goes on. And then the last thing was decoherence and thermalization and fluid mechanics. So decoherence, thermalization, and fluid mechanics. So I told you that there was a fluid mechanics would come into this, and that's so the issue here is similar to the issue of positronium. For positronium, for the first time you're imagining that there's processes that take you to states that were not in your low energy theory. And so the penalty you paid for that was that your effective Hamiltonian was no longer Hermitian, so that you have a non-unitary process which is small but there. For this, what's happening is that if you have an environment which is moving through a thermal bath, previously an assumption in everything that I would have said to this point would have been that whatever the state was you're ignoring, it was in a pure state. And that's certainly not true if you're moving through a thermal environment. And so that means that in particular, if you start off with a particle that's in a pure state and it interacts with the environment, it won't stay in a pure state. It'll generally become mixed. And that's the decoherence process. And that means that the influence of the environment is not being captured by an effective Hamiltonian, because the one thing you knew about an effective Hamiltonian would be that it would take a pure state to a pure state. So the description here is going to have to be different from an effective Hamiltonian description. Part of it will be in here, this mean field story. The Markov process you set up is a differential equation for the density matrix, and so it's a master equation. But there's a more general story here at long distances. Again, much like for the quantum Hall effect, there are some things you can say which are much better approximations than these intermediate steps, like this master equation description. Fluid mechanics, if you're trying to follow things at very long distances and very long timescales, the efficient way to do that is to follow the conserved thing. But typically, the message of fluid mechanics is that if you have things that are interacting on very, very quickly on very small distances compared to what you're trying to follow, then things like where particle x is, it will be difficult to follow because it's going to change very quickly. But if you want to actually move momentum from here to here, or move charge from here to here, then it has to physically get from here to here, and that's a slow process. And so what will happen is that the things that dominate at low energies will be the motion of the conserved quantities, and the reason that's slow is that the microscopic interactions couldn't change them because they were conserved. And so by following the conserved quantities, and in particular, instead of following the effect of Hamiltonian, what you instead do is follow the average conserved things, like the average stress energy, or the average charge density, or the average current density, then that naturally leads to a long distance description, which is what you, which what fluid mechanics is. So the leading part here would be the Navier-Stokes equations, and it's the, it kind of plugs into the normal thing you see in a statistical mechanics course. But the message would be that they're all really special cases of this one organizing principle, which is that you have a hierarchy of scales. It might have been mass scales in particle physics. It might have been energy levels in atomic physics. It might have been time scales, like correlation times versus other times in condensed matter physics or fluid mechanics. But it's the same principles of organization are applying, that it's that you can think of local physics. The short distance stuff, the short fast stuff, is being parameterized by local things, and there's not that many ways to do it if there's a lot of symmetries in your problem. And so that's the list. And so it's clear we're not going to get through this whole list because there's lots and lots of nice topics there. And so for next week, I'd like you to think about which of these topics you'd like to have covered. So I'll have a priority list as I go through. But in each of these sections, I'd like to do some relativistic ones and some non-relativistic ones. But which ones I do depend a little bit on what your interests are. And so I tried to, as I've talked about them, say what the general principles are that come up for each one, and that should give you some guidance as to what you want to see. So it's not just a random walk through examples. Each one has a little lesson, but there's so many lessons in this area that it's you have to stop somewhere. Any questions about that? All right. References, there are there's a variety of references. There's no really classic book, I don't think, on this. There's a number of things that are the books that touch on this. So there's Weinberg's Field Theory book, Volume 3, talks a lot about many of these ideas in the context of If you haven't read his quantum field theory books, there's or volume two, I guess. Volume one is foundational stuff, and that's like that you should read every year because you learn something every time you read it, but it's really hard to read. And then volume two is kind of the applications, and that has lots of cool applications. But in particular, it talks about some of these effective field theory ideas in the applications. There's a book by Howard Georgi. Which has particle physics in the title, and I've forgotten now what the rest of the title is. But I think it's the only book he has which has particle physics explicitly in the title. And that's about the Standard Model. It's written, it's kind of old now. It's written in the late 70s, early 80s. But it's a very, very nice, approachable introduction to it. And in particular, it talks about chiral perturbation theory and the Fermi theory of the weak interactions in a way which is using in practice these effective field theory ideas. There's the classic, most of these ideas start from, there's an article by Weinberg in 1979. It's the Physica article. It's in a Festschrift for somebody, and I forgot who that somebody was. I think it was Schwinger, Julian Schwinger. I think it was Schwinger because but there was actually very recently he posted. It'll be cited in also there was a this year. There was a he did a memoir this year on the archive. This summer, and it's basically about effective field theories. And he's kind of reminiscing. It's the 20th anniversary, 30th anniversary of this paper. He was at a meeting in Switzerland where they were asking him kind of what the thought process was that came to this article. In this article, what he's doing is he's summarizing the previous 20 years of the developments in pion physics, where they basically invented the rules of power perturbation theory. And he says in here something which was in the air. So I was a student of his not much later than this. And I had a sense that when he was teaching the stuff in his field course, that it was stuff that they understood in the 60s, and it was dead stuff. But what he describes here is that it was actually, he just was figuring it out between 1976 and 1979, the generality of it, because he gave a series of lectures in 1976 at Erice, which are also very good, about critical phenomenon in condensed matter physics and their normalization group. And in doing that, kind of made the connection between non-normalizability and how you power count. But this paper sets it out for pions explicitly for one loop calculations and what the principles are. And most of everything else is just really working this through in different examples. And it kind of always annoys me that he didn't kind of point out at the time that this was actually a fairly new idea, and that there were zillions of ways to apply this idea. Because as a graduate student, that would have been really useful information to know. And so the people who organized this meeting that he's at for this thing, you know, jumped on it in the early 80s. And I remember reading those papers thinking, yeah, but this is stuff that I thought they understood in the 60s. And they were actually working out, you know, systematically what the rules for chiral perturbation theory were in the effective field theory language. And so it was it's very, very nicely written articles, easy to access. And it kind of is the foundation on which everything else is based. And then I'm working from various parts of this through some lecture notes of my own, which I can give you when I get to those parts. There's and I'm also using effective field theory lecture notes. There's a lot of effective field theory review articles on the archive, and many of them are very good. There's a lot of them on chiral perturbation theory in particular, but some of the gravity ones I'm going to talk about in particular for non-relativistic systems. There's a nice review article by Walter Goldberger on the archive, which is Lesueux lecture notes. And there's a very nice article, which kind of is a combination of chiral perturbation theory and effective field theory in general and some extra-dimensional physics, written by Ira Rothstein about it's TASI lecture notes of a couple years ago. You know, Anish Manohar and Howard Georgi have also had lecture notes on these things, and almost everybody who's worked in chiral perturbation theory has a nice set of lecture notes on it. So there's lots of if you go to Spires or Google and you search for effective field theory reviews, you'll get a long list, and many of them are very good. But I'm not going to work from any one of them really. All right, if there's no questions, then let me carry on. So what I want to do is start with a toy model. And I'm going to choose one that illustrates a number of the points, the idea. And I want to choose one that you're all familiar with so that you know what the answer is going to be. But I'm going to choose it because it brings out several of the things I mentioned. It's going to be it's an example where you can calculate everything. In perturbation theory, it's an example where you have a low energy limit, which is cleanly identifiable. It's an example where that low energy limit has properties that you would have thought were not very accurate if you believe the calculation the way I'm going to do it the first time. But then when you look at it more generally, there's a symmetry reason and a low energy reason why the properties are what they are. And it's an example of Goldstone bosons in particular. And so it kind of allows many of these threads to come together in a simpler way. And it's good to have a concrete example. When we start talking about the formalism, that's the part which I'm worried is going to be the driest part, where we're just talking about what effective field theories are, blah, 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 blah. And having this example in mind is going to be useful because thinking through what I'm telling you in a specific example makes it all very obvious, and there's nothing very, very complicated about it. But if you just say it all abstractly, it sounds like it's hard. So the model will be just lambda phi forward theory. So we'll take the Lagrangian to be minus, it'll be a complex scalar field, d mu phi, minus the potential energy for phi star phi. And I'll take a quartic potential energy. And for those in the know, I'm doing that because that's renormalizable, but that's, you know, it's not going to be such a big deal. So I'm going to use this particular way of describing it, phi star phi minus v squared squared. So if I had expanded that out, that would be lambda squared over 4. Let me start on the other side. I guess it would be v to the 4th minus lambda squared over 2 v squared phi star phi plus lambda squared over 4. So it's quartic. Lambda is the quartic coupling. I write it as a square because we want that to be positive, so the energy is bounded from below. This is a vacuum energy term, which I've chosen to make the potential be minimized to zero, and it's not really important for anything I'm going to say. And this is the mass term, and you see that the sign is wrong. So it's not positive. Normally you would have called this m squared, and the fact that this is negative is a sign that it's... you shouldn't be, you have to think more carefully about what the spectrum of the theory is. And you can also see from this that the potential energy is clearly minimized when phi star phi is non-zero. And so this is an example of spontaneous symmetry breaking. And that's going to be important in the story I want to tell. So the story I want to tell is I want to calculate for this theory what the spectrum is. And it's you can almost see what it's going to be already. There's going to be, it's a complex scalar field. So there's two real scalar fields. They're going to have different masses. If I'd chosen this to be positive sign, we would have had two real fields with the same mass, and so it would have been then convenient to keep them in a complex field, and it would be then there would be a symmetry which would rotate them into one another. The symmetry, this whole thing is designed to be invariant under phi goes to e to the I theta phi, where theta does not depend on position, and then this is invariant under that. And so if this had a positive coefficient, this symmetry would have related the two particles we'd have, and that would be explaining why they have the same mass. But because we have a non-zero value in the potential, what's going to happen is that one of these fields will get a mass which will be of the order of lambda v from this term, but there's going to be another degree of freedom. This is the potential if we drew it. It's this Mexican hat thing, right? That if you imagine drawing it in two dimensions, there's a minimum at non-zero value of phi, and then there's a symmetry where we rotate the phase. So that means that there's a trough along the bottom of the potential which has exactly the same energy because all those states are related by a symmetry, and they're all exactly degenerate. So that's the set of ground states which are responsible for the spontaneous symmetry breaking. And this being negative is a statement that at phi equals zero, the curvature there is negative. But the real vacuum is over here. So when we expand around here, what we're expecting, given that the curvature of the potential at the minimum is the mass, there's a positive direction, which will be the mass of the particle, and there's a zero direction, which is the symmetry direction, and that'll be the Goldstone boson. So I'm going to do this explicitly, but the story will be that there's a heavy particle, oscillations in this direction, there's a light particle going around the circle, and I'm going to be interested in how they scatter with one another. And the calculation will be calculate the masses for small lambda, and then calculate the scattering amplitude of the light particle with the heavy particle and with itself. And I'll show you that the scattering amplitude is smaller than you would have thought it was going to be, just based on looking at potential energy. And so then the question will be, is there a way of organizing the calculation to make that more obvious? And that'll be the low energy expansion. One thing we're going to have to agree on too is if we do this from 10 to 12 in the morning, are you guys going to need a break at 11? Or is 2 hours too long? Think about that for next time, because next time I'll dive in right at the very beginning, and so there'll be less talk. But it's sometimes true that your buffer fills, and so when if your buffer's all full, then it's pointless to keep talking. So think about whether you need a break at 11. And we can take a 5-minute break. Okay, so here's our theory, and we want to analyze it. And so the usual story here is that we're going to perturb and we're going to take lambda small. So we're going to analyze in limit lambda much less than 1. Now, naively, that would make you think that, well, so we're supposed to perturb around, you know, this whole thing's a perturbation, so that the zeroth order approximation, we drop the whole thing and we've got two massless particles. And that's not right. That's what's going on there is that the smallness of lambda, the small lambda limit is more of a semi-classical limit than it is a dropping the interactions limit. And that's because it depends on what's being held fixed when lambda gets small. And we have to ask what happens to V and to phi as lambda gets small. And we're interested in a limit where phi is of the order of 1 over root lambda, or 1 over lambda, the way I'm writing it. So that the interesting limit for the spectrum, and in particular this whole classical story I'm telling you, is going to be, we have to be more clear about what's happening to these other things as lambda gets small. And in particular, to make the point that the lambda small limit is a semi-classical limit, I can write the action in such a way that you can see the lambda pulls out in front of the whole action, and so it's not distinguishing this term from this term or these terms from each other. And so that's a useful way to write the action. So the first claim is the lambda goes to zero limit is a semi-classical limit. So to do that, it's all to do with what these things do. So what I need to do is just scale things properly, right? So if I take, let's say that we write lambda phi, let's write that as being, what do I want to do here? One over lambda times curly phi. And then what I'll have to do is I'll have to take V and write it as being mu over lambda. And what I'll do is I'll take lambda to be going to zero with curly phi and mu fixed rather than capital phi or regular phi and V fixed. So we'll hold phi and mu fixed. So when you say that small lambda limit, it was ambiguous until we said what else was being fixed in that limit. And so writing it that way, you know, the Lagrangian becomes 1 over lambda squared. So then I've got d mu curly phi minus d mu curly phi d mu curly phi. And then the potential is now minus, I've got lambda squared over 4 curly phi star curly phi minus mu squared all divided by lambda squared squared. So so I've got altogether 1 over lambda to the 4th times lambda squared here, so that's another 1 over lambda squared, so I can close this bracket and pull these lambdas out. And that's the statement. So if I'm holding curly phi and mu fixed, then you can see that lambda is appearing where h bar would have appeared. If we write the action as being, you know, inside the path integral, we'd have e to the I action over h bar if I put the h bars back in. So that would be, you know, e to the I, the integral d4x over h bar times the Lagrangian. So if I have a 1 over lambda in front of the whole Lagrangian, then the lambda is just sitting here in front of the h bar. And so the small lambda limit will be the small h bar limit, and that'll be the classical limit. So that's what the statement is behind. So in parentheses, I should say, if we hold. And that's the one that we traditionally do when looking at the ground state. So classically, the classical approximation will be the leading approximation. And we're thinking that the powers of h bar in the quantum approximation will be powers of lambda, and that'll be what suppresses them. In the classical approximation, if we ask what's the ground state, you know, when you find the spectrum of a theory, what are you really doing? You're normally asking what's the ground state of the Hamiltonian, and then what are the states that are just above the ground state? Those are the ones that are normally the most interest in any system. How far above will be depending on the problem, and so we'll have to make that more explicit here. But if we ask what the ground state is in the classical approximation, it's clear from this Lagrangian, if we take the Hamiltonian, So the Hamiltonian density would be the Lagrangian density, or it would be the momentum density times, you know, phi dot minus the Lagrangian density. If I calculate that for this Lagrangian, it becomes just phi star dot phi star. So there's kinetic energy, sorry, phi, plus grad phi star dot grad phi plus v of phi star phi. So if I want to know what's the minimum energy in the classical approximation, I should be asking for classical field configurations which minimize this. It's a sum of positive things, so that's a good thing. So they have to, we can minimize it by making them all zero, and we know we can make them all zero, so that must be the minimum because it's non-negative. And so the minimum will be h equals zero, and that means that phi dot has to be equal to zero, grad phi has to be equal to zero, and v of phi star phi has to be equal to zero, and that means that phi star phi has to be little v squared. So that's the minimum. So the physical intuition that we're minimizing this potential is coming from the semi-classical approximation, which is justified by small lambda. And the assumption that we make normally that phi is not depending on space-time is coming from the minimization of the gradient energies, and so we're in business. Yeah. Yes, thank you. I should also say that these signs, if you're trying to reproduce the signs, my conventions are that the metric is minus 1, 1, 1, 1. And you know, partial mu is, yeah, I'm sure you know, is partial partial x mu. And x mu is you know, time, space, where that's mu equals 0, and this is 1, 2, and 3. And when we get to gravity, I'm going to use Weinberg's curvature conventions, which are the same as MTW's, except the curvature tensor, the Riemann tensor is an opposite sign, but everything else is the same. All right. Okay. All right, now we look at fluctuations around, so if you want to know the spectrum near the minimum in the semi-classical approximation, it's like talking about molecules and vibrational modes. We've got a minimum. If we perturb away from the ground state, we're going to get small oscillations around the minimum. That'll look like a harmonic oscillator if the amplitude of the oscillation is small enough. And so if we perturb around that, if we quantize that, we should be getting energy levels which are evenly spaced, and those are the particles. And so what we do is the low-level exciting excitations. So we write phi as being v plus, what do I call it? I'll write the real and imaginary part. 1 over root 2 phi r for the real part plus I. And that's going to be hard to see. Let's say r plus I. So this is the real part, and this is the imaginary part of the field. So R of X and I of X are real fields. So the kinetic energy, then the 1 over root 2 is conventional. So d mu phi will be 1 over root 2. This has got no derivative in it because it's just a number. D mu R plus I. And so d mu phi star phi, because it's a complex conjugate, I'm going to get this plus I times this minus I. And so the things that are imaginary are going to cancel. And so I'll just end up with getting the real part squared plus the imaginary part squared. And this 1 over root 2 will come along as a 1 half. And the potential energy, if we expand that out, that was lambda squared over 4, pi star phi minus v squared. So that's, I probably would have preferred to have v squared over 2, but I'm stuck now, I guess. So that's lambda squared over 4 squared, thank you. Yeah. 1 half r squared plus I squared minus v squared. Oh, right, I have to shift phi. So what I should do is I should write, before I write this down, let me write what phi star phi is. So phi star phi is going to be v plus 1 over root 2 r plus I. Same thing where I have minus I. So that'll be the real part squared. So I'll have v plus 1 over root 2 r squared plus 1 half I squared. So v is going to be lambda squared over 2, 4. Is, so this thing minus the v squared is going to have the cross term. So there'll be a root 2 v r. Then we'll have the plus 1 half r squared plus I squared squared. Did I do that right? So when we square it out, that's going to be, this thing squared will be, there'll be 2, so we'll have 1 half lambda squared v squared r squared plus, then we have the cross term, so we'll have 2 times 2 is 1 times root 2, so I'll have, I want to get this, these numbers right because I'm going to use them in a second, lambda squared over 4, root 2, so root 2 over 4 is, I guess, it's 1 over 2 root 2. V r squared plus I squared. And then we have the quartic piece, which is lambda squared over 4 squared. If I write that out, there's an r to the fourth term plus an I to the fourth term plus the 2 r squared I squared. Right. So now, if we're thinking of, you know, small amplitude fluctuations, then the the approximation where we're thinking of small fluctuations here as being a harmonic oscillator correspond to dropping everything beyond quadratic order in the fluctuations in the Hamiltonian, which would be keeping this term and the kinetic term, and these will all be in the interaction term. We have Lagrangian would be the zeroth order piece plus the interaction piece, or the zeroth order piece is minus 1 half mu r d mu r minus 1 half mu I minus 1 half m squared r squared, where you can read off that m squared is whatever that coefficient is, m squared v squared, so m is lambda v. Then the interaction term is the cubic and higher parts. There's a lambda minus lambda squared v over 2 root 2 4. So the spectrum would be, we've got a massive R particle. That was the one that corresponded to oscillations in this radial direction, which had curvature. There's a massless I particle, which corresponds to, if that's the real direction, And the transverse direction is the one that's tangentially along this flat fraction. That's why it was zero. And then there's interactions amongst them, which is just describing the general curve. In fact, this tends to go off across, but it curves is the shape I and R interact with each other. Right. So let me. Oh, did I get that wrong? Oh, I forgot the 1/2 here you're saying. Yeah, right. Thank you. I'm glad you correct these things because I'm going to use this to calculate something, and if I get it wrong here, then I'll get it wrong all the way down. So the masses of the so we have particles that are weakly interacting to the extent that we're dominated by L naught, and the R particle is one of the mass eigenstates, and it has a mass which is lambda b. And the I particle has got mass. So there's a hierarchy of scales here. There's a massless state and there's a massive state. That's which is one of the things that we want to start off with to talk about effectively. So ultimately, what we're going to be interested in is we're going to be interested in the low energy part of the theory, this thing. And we're going to be interested in the effects at low energies due to virtual heavy particles. This is the heavy high energy part. So let's look at that. So let's calculate the. Let me just do the example I've done here, so I don't completely get everything wrong. Let me also make. Yeah, that looks right. Let's still oh, did I oh you're right. Yeah, I should have written it was R squared plus I squared, yeah. Thanks. So the basic vertices in the problem would be if I call make this a heavy line and this a dotted line, say. Then the basic vertices are we have an R cubed term, which is like three heavy lines. We have an R I squared term, which is like a line, a heavy line and two dotted lines. We have an I to the fourth term, which is two dotted lines crossing. There's an R to the fourth term, which is two heavy lines crossing, and there's an R squared I squared term, which is two heavy lines meeting two dotted lines. Those are the interactions we have, and we have specific normalizations for them, which we read off from that potential. So let's calculate the scattering. So we're interested in the low energy sector of this theory, which is the I particles, and let's ask how they scatter from each other. And they should do because there's a potential energy for them all. And so what we'll do is we'll just calculate that in the full theory. And then we'll ask, how does that compare to the, is there a more efficient way to do it than what we're the way I'm going to do it? So we're going to calculate my scattering. And because of this application effect of field theories in mind, we're going to imagine that the energy in the scattering is small compared to this mass. So we're in the limit. Where the center of mass energy is much less than the R mass. One thing that always comes up for effective field theories is people say, well, how can it be possible that you can distinguish the low energy limit from the high energy limit of something in a Lorentz invariant way, given that if I think that this energy is low, somebody boosted by it will think that it's high? And that's a red herring in the sense that the everybody agrees on what the center mass energy is. That's an invariant concept. All observers can agree on what the center mass of a process is. So the invariant statement will typically be that the center mass energy is small. And the fallacy and the worry of the fact that there exists frames for which everything's happening at high energies, The reason that's irrelevant is that for there to be an efficient low energy description, it's not true that it has to be true for all frames that's a low energy description. There only has to exist a frame for which there's a low energy description. And then if there exists a frame where there's a clean hierarchy of scales and you're asking a low energy question, then the effective field theory analysis will apply in that frame. And then to the extent that you're calculating things that are Lorentz invariant, you'll find that you're getting Lorentz invariant criteria for the answer. And so what we're going to find when we do this calculation is that the center mass energy being small compared to MR is going to be the important thing, rather than saying the energy of the scattering of one of the I particles isn't going to be the important thing. But you can phrase it any way you like, but the real point is that it's sufficient for there to exist an observer who sees a useful description in terms of hierarchies of scale. And then if you're calculating things like cross-sections that are Lorentz invariant, you're going to find that they organize themselves with Lorentz invariant criteria for what the scale separation is. All right. They should both have the minus sign. Because the interaction is, it's always kinetic minus potential. Yeah, thanks. Yeah, it's good to catch these things on the board because it's the kind of thing that your notes will never make sense otherwise. I used to pay, if I'm doing an undergraduate class, I'd pay people for mistakes they catch on the board, but I'll be broke with you guys. So I'm going to at least see how it goes before I start. I used to give people the smallest coin in my pocket. And once you get past the first few pennies, then you're into loonies and toonies, and it starts to get expensive. So, all right, so let's look at something like, we're looking at a process like this, where two I particles go in, two I particles go out, say time is going that way, and something happens. And so now we want to calculate in the semi-classical approximation what that something is. And so in the semi-classical approximation, in powers of H bar, the semi-classical approximation is the loop expansion. So what we should first be doing is looking for graphs that describe this process with no loops in them. So we want to evaluate this in the loop expansion, which is justified by the semi-classical approximation. And I'm not explaining that, but if you've done a field theory course, you know that. And if you don't, then come and ask me about it later on. But it's what we're ultimately going to find is that because the loop expansion is controlled by the semi-classical expansion, that means it's going to be controlled by powers of lambda in our case. So that's what's going to be justifying the neglect of the loops. And of course, you should always be asking what suppresses the things you didn't calculate. So what are the graphs? Let me just see if I can get them now. So we're going to have, we have to build a graph with these end final states from these ingredients. One of them is obvious. We have an I to the fourth thing. We have this graph plus, we could take this two of these graphs and string them together. And this is an S-channel process, but we could also do this in the T-channel, thinking that time's going left to right. And we could probably also cross those things. Whether that's a separate graph or not, I can't remember, but I'll just write them because we always have to check that. And then what else can we do? So we use that one, we use that one. We use this one, we have to get rid of these guys somehow, and they're not in the final state, so they have to be a loop, and so we're never going to do that if it's a loop graph, unless it's a loop graph. So we're probably done. So the amplitude, let's say that we have momentum P, P and Q flowing in, and P prime and Q prime flowing out. And we're looking for the amplitude as a function of P, Q, P prime, and Q prime. And it'll be something. So it'll start off with the things that come from kinematics. There'll be something enforcing momentum conservation, right? So if we put in the Feynman rules, there'll be an I 2 pi to the fourth, a delta function for reinforcing momentum conservation times. I don't want to write these all the time. So let me call this capital A, and then this coefficient I'll call little a. And little a, or curly a, will be the thing coming from these coupling constants and the propagators. So we're going to have, so this thing here will give us a factor of, where's our interactions? They're up there. we don't want to keep those. Actually, I guess we can, let me, here we are. So we can read off the what counts. So now that we've seen that we don't need this, I'm going to erase these. We didn't need this. So all we need are these two things. So let me rewrite this one. So we have R I squared. And it came with a coefficient, which was R I squared. So it's minus lambda squared V over 2 root 2. And I should be comparing this to, let me call the coefficient of this thing. Supposing the coefficient of this thing had been g over 2, and the coefficient of this thing I had written as being g prime over 4 factorial. This is 2 factorial. So what I'm doing is I'm dividing by, anytime I have a field repeated, I'm dividing by that factorial. So if it, with that convention, the actual thing in Lagrangian we had was this, and so the thing I would call G in this convention would be this, right? Because the two I'm making explicit here. So here what I would do, that the coefficient in the Lagrangian for I to the fourth was lambda squared over 16. So G prime is going to be lambda squared over 16 times 4 factorial, right? Which is 4 times 3 is 24. That'll be 3 lambda squared over 2. And that's a useful thing to do, because when you calculate the Feynman rules, there's always these combinatorial factors, right? That when we draw a graph like this, say, what we're doing is we're imagining that we had an interaction in the Lagrangian which had creation and destruction operators at all three of these places. And we had some initial state and some final state. And we're asking all possible ways in which we can imagine the initial state and the final state matching up with these creation and annihilation operators in the interaction, and then the ones that are not involved in the final state have to then create and destroy the corresponding particle. And there's a number of ways that when we write something like phi to the fourth here, there's a whole bunch of permutations as to which particle gets killed by which particular power of phi in that interaction. And in particular, you can kind of see that if you have an interaction like this, and you have two internal initial and final states, if you ask what are the number of ways I can connect this thing up to get a graph like this, well, I say, well, the first one can connect to any one of these four things. There'll be four ways to do that. And this one can connect up with any one of these three. So there'll be three ways of doing that. This one can connect up with any one of those two that are left. And then this one's unique. And it doesn't make a difference which one I do, because all these things give me the same contribution in the Feynman graph. So this factor of 4 factorial is always going to be in that graph. And so it's useful to have this thing explicitly outside to cancel it. And so this normalization is a useful convention, because you're going to get an answer which just depends on these g's without extraneous factors of combinatorics. Shouldn't be. So what I really imagine is that the Lagrangian would have been minus this, and it was equal to minus this. So I would make the sign positive for g. But because of that minus sign, so since L interaction is minus V, and I'm counting the couplings in V that way, if I look at this graph here, there'll be a minus sign because I got one factor of an interaction here. And then I have G, let me call this G, not this G, let me call it G4. And I'll call this one G3. So this graph will give me minus g4, and then the 4 factorial denominator will cancel the 4 factorial coming from building the graph. And then we'll have plus, now these graphs, they all come from two factors of the interaction, so there's two factors of minus 1, and that's important for the relative sign of these terms. And then we're going to get, for each of them gives us a G3 squared. And then there's a number of ways in which we can combine them. And there's the propagators involved. So there's going to be, in this way, there's two ways of combining the initial state with this thing, and there's two in this thing. And but this interaction was designed to have a factor of 1/2 here twice. So what we're going to do is that this is going to combine with the statistical factors of the ways in which we could take, if we started off with this and said, how many ways can I string this together to look like this? The answer would be, if I take this one can combine with one of those four. That's the first one, let's say. But then if I want this graph to happen, then the other one has to then come out here too. So there's two ways. There's a factor of 2 from the choice of which vertex. So I should have that here somewhere. So this 2 is coming from the fact that I could connect with either vertex. But once I've done that, the second one is fixed. And I have two ways in which these guys can combine. And that's canceled by the 2 explicitly in the Lagrangian. But let me write them all. So and I'm thinking they're going to be all the same. So let me write them all on front. And I'm probably going to be wrong when I do that. So let's just do it. Let's just do it right. So we have 1. So there's a factor of 1/2. There's always a factor of 1/2 in second order perturbation theory, because when we take the exponential of the Hamiltonian and we write out the second term with two interactions in it, there's a 1/2 factorial from that. That's going to cancel the two ways to combine these vertices in all these graphs. For this graph, so we've done the two ways of combining the vertices. Once we took one end, the other one was unique, and then we had two ways of combining these two. So we have 2, and then each of these couplings had a 1/2 in front of it. So it was really, so if I just, one way to think of that is that we have a G3/2 squared here. For this thing, we do the same thing. How many ways can we make this graph? We have factor 2 for which vertex, that's that factor of 2. So let's say we do this one. Once we've done that, then we have 2 choices here, which could be that state. Actually, there's 2 or 1. If I'm distinguishing these two things, it's just 1, right? And then this one had a choice of 2, and then that was it. So there's a 2. Oh, but sorry, I forgot the propagator factor. This propagator now going to be, there'll be a 2 divided by the propagator for this line will be, the momentum flowing in here is p plus q squared plus the mass of the air particle squared. And this one we got, if this remember was q and that was p, then this one will be q prime. So if I take this momentum here, it would have been q minus q prime squared plus mr squared. And in this graph, it's q minus p. Let me do p. I'll do p minus p prime here, the same thing. I always have a p in this thing, and this will be p minus q prime squared plus mr squared. And there's, again, two ways to do this one. So altogether, if I've done this right, yeah, you're right, and that's going to cancel that one everywhere. Yeah, so 4, 4. I was expecting that to go away. Normally, what that means is that you can forget those factors. So, those are all canceling those. Those are canceling those, and so that's what looks right. So, let me just erase them all now. This is just all now. This is G3 squared 1, 1, 1. Good. So that's the amplitude, and I'll just let me pull out this overall minus sign. All right, so I should probably stop now because I'm out of time. Where I'm going with this is we're going to be interested in the low energy limit, right? So the thing I haven't used yet is that we want to do this, we're going to do the calculation in this limit here. And that is, means that I'm going to be allowed to Taylor expand these propagators because these things are going to be small compared to these things. And the claim I'm going to make is that when we do that Taylor expansion, this looks like it's an interesting scattering amplitude, right? But when we do the calculation for low momenta and keep work to fix powers of external momenta, you're going to see that the coefficients are going to vanish. The first thing that's non-zero has 8 powers of momenta in it, which is kind of funny. You would have thought that it would be a miracle if I did a Taylor expansion of this thing and I happened to get 0 right out to 8 powers of momenta. But that's what's going to happen. And so that's why I wanted to be very anal about getting these numerical factors and signs right, because it's not only going to happen when I put in, the answer is going to depend on the explicit value of the mass and the explicit value of these couplings and those signs. And those couplings involve the same parameters as did the masses, because the mass is also lambda v. And when I combine it all together, you're going to see that the first few powers of this thing are going to be 0. And this is an exercise that's worth doing. And that looks like a miracle in this calculation. It looks like there's a potential energy which should have been scattering things, but for some reasons not. And so if we lived in a world where this was describing our standard model and we were building our LHC to test it, then and we're at low energies, then you would have thought that, geez, you know, we thought that we could measure the scattering because it was going to happen fairly frequently, but we're at low energies and it's happening that this leading approximation is small. Maybe what we should do is include the loop corrections and calculate the order lambda corrections to it. So just to give you a preview, we're tempted to say from that calculation that the rate for II scattering seems to go like the energy to the fourth power or eighth power. And on dimensional grounds, that has to be an energy that's length squared, so it should be one over energy. It must be divided by mr to the tenth with some factor. And so you're expected to think, well, the thing that I didn't do was loops, and that should be suppressed by powers of lambda. So maybe it should be h bar, and h bar was lambda. So you're thinking that, well, this is small, but this thing doesn't have to be suppressed by powers of, you know, 8 powers of energy. So maybe what it should be is that maybe it's lambda times, you know, 1 over e squared, which could be allowed in dimensional grounds. For small energies, then this could be, even though it was smaller in powers of lambda, it could be winning because the energy dependence is much more favorable at low energies. Or maybe it's just, you know, maybe it's e squared over m to the fourth or something like that, you know, but not suppressed by 8 powers of energy. And if that wasn't true, you might say, well, maybe I should have gone to 2 loops, maybe at lambda squared. If lambda is only 0.1, but this energy ratio is 10 to the minus 3 or something like that, then you can go a lot of loops and still win if you can get a weaker power in energy. And so you can imagine, you know, an industry of particle physicists calculating this thing out to 15,000 loops, trying to find the thing that's going to be the first thing you see at their LHC. And it would be futile because the statement is that to all orders in lambda, every term here starts off at e to the 8th over m to the 8th, and e to the 8th over m to the 10th. And that's true for every lambda. And that would be very hard to see the way we're calculating it because it's coming to us as an intricate cancellation amongst terms that all could have themselves been non-zero. And so in this particular example, the point of the effective field theory will be when we write this as an effective field theory for the scattering of where the interactions amongst the I's due to the R's is given to us in terms of effective interactions, it will be explicit. Those things come with derivatives. And those derivatives are always going to be forcing us to have these powers of energy necessarily. And so it'll be obvious that no matter how we calculate this thing, as long as we're in the low energy limit, this thing has to vanish like 8 powers of the energy, regardless of how many orders of lambda you had calculated in computing those effective interactions. And so this is an example where it's extremely useful to know that the smallness of this cross-section at low energies has nothing to do with the smallness of lambda. It's to do with a symmetry in the problem and the smallness, and then that symmetry is making all the interactions turn off at low energies in a very predictable way, which is basically Goldstone's theorem. And so the low energy, exploiting this low energy limit would be the only efficient way to do this calculation if you lived in that world. And so it really draws out how useful the low energy perspective is in practice identifying how big the corrections are to what you're doing. So I'll pick it up. I'll pick all that up next time. So think about for next time how you want this course to be marked. And the second thing was, which of these examples you want to be looking through as we get through the term?